This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
From being someone who's maybe totally new to the issue of psychiatric medications to someone who is now one of the leading authorities of a critical perspective on psychiatric drugs.
It would start maybe with developing my own understanding of psychoactive drug effects as a, you know, as an adolescent or young adult who experimented with drugs. Maybe that's a way to begin that story.
And David, you say psychoactive drug effects, and that's an interesting term. Can you explain to us what you mean by that? Because that's kind of a little bit of a different way of understanding psychiatric drugs as part of a broader category of drugs, right?
Yes, I think that's a good point you're making, and that's something that may have taken me decades to really fully understand. But at some point after studying drugs for many years, as an individual, as a researcher, as an author, as a therapist, as someone who interviewed many, many people taking drugs, I begin to think that all drugs are equal. All drugs fit into the same niche, same ecological niche. Especially drugs that we call psychoactive, meaning drugs that make us feel through probably first their action on the brain, but with many other factors that we can discuss. But drugs that make us feel different than ourselves or much more of ourselves than we've ever felt before. Drugs that make us change or alter the way we think, how we think, the way we feel, the way we act. Commonly, that's alcohol. That's the classic drug that most people can relate to. But it includes coffee. It includes Prozac. It includes Ritalin. It includes tea. It includes cocaine. All the drugs, licit or illicit, that really alter how we feel, how we think, how we behave, would be called psychoactive drugs.
One of the things that's most compelling about your work for me is that you don't just emphasize the chemical process that's going on. You also look at the social context, the relationships, the way that the drugs are used, the expectations, all the different messages that go along with taking drugs. And I think that you've really reached a much more comprehensive and in-depth understanding of how these medications work and don't work and what they're doing or not doing to us than I think is often discussed, because we're so much focused on brain science and how chemistry affects the brain. And you've really got much more of a social perspective on drugs in general.
What I've tried to do is I've really tried to contribute to a much more social way of understanding psychoactive drug effects. And that social way includes our perceptions, our attitudes, our ideas, our feelings, our hopes. All of this stuff are rituals, the very rituals we use even to take, to handle, to manage, to distribute, to prescribe the drugs. All of that actually does play, I believe, almost directly into the effects that we experience while taking the drugs. So that's, I have tried again to really, I think, broaden or to understand drug effects in a much more social way than I've seen most discussions of drug effects.
Let's start with the whole question of, well, don't the drugs work? I mean, psychiatric drugs are used widely. There's this incredible marketing industry around them. And yet at the same time, you've been one of the people who's been exposing the fact that, well, the actual effectiveness of the drugs isn't what we think of it as. And the whole idea of psychiatric drugs working or not working itself is a very complicated question. So tell us a little bit about what you've discovered in your research about this question of, do psychiatric drugs work?
The very phrase or that word working, how do they work or do they, by definition, that's a metaphor for something. And we say, you know, does the car work? Does the engine work? Is your job working for you? So in essence, we're trying to express some kind of fit or some kind of functioning of something that meets some goal that we have. And if it does, we'll say, well, it works. But the question, therefore, is, well, what's your goal? Who's asking? Who's talking? Who's evaluating? Who's deciding whether it works or not? And I think the key to the answer is really in that. So that depending on who you are and what you're looking for, the drug either works or doesn't work. And it may work at some times, but not work at other times in the same person. It may work for one purpose, but not work for another. So what I'm trying to say is this is really a relative notion. Do the drugs work? But having said all this, if you ask the people who promote the drugs, you could say the psychiatric or the psychopharmacological establishment, generally speaking, according to their evidence, the drugs are not working very well. And what I mean by that is I'm pointing to the three major studies released, funded by the NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health, without presumably direct drug industry funding.
What is it we're talking about when we're talking about effectiveness? What is it that we're really getting at? Because your work has been debunking the idea that the drugs are making some huge difference in people's lives. And you've really been asking us to look at other factors in what is it that actually helps people.
I guess the way to understand that is to say, well, what's the context in which a drug is being given or a person is taking a drug? And that's what I try to do. I try to understand the context of ingesting a drug, feeling its effects. And so the context has to include a lot of different things. It first includes immediately a place. It includes a space, a physical geographical space. It could be an office. It could be a jail cell. It could be a hospital room. It could be a padded cell. It could be the countryside. It could be on the beach. So there's a space where this is being done. So that has to be considered, I believe. Is it a healing space? Is it an oppressive space? Does the space smell good? Does it sound good? Is it pleasant? Is it harsh? Is it aggressive? That's part of the context. And I think that the context has to have something to do with how you feel the effects of something that's given to you as a treatment.
I think people listening might say, well, you know, sure, whether it takes place in the countryside or in a doctor's office or a jail cell, that might make a little bit of a difference. But really, that's not going to be the determining factor. And actually, you're saying that there's research that shows that the context issues are even more important than the specific drug that's being used.
And if we took some time and really just looked at the physical environment, we might explain a lot of drug effects. But then you look, there's a social environment, which is there's a relationship. And that relationship could be from, you know, your ideal, supportive, libertarian, enhancing and affirming relationship all the way down to the most oppressive, you know, totalitarian, if you will, relationship that you can have with an individual or a group of people that may be oppressing you or helping you. You know, are you talking to someone who's been there before and has lived a lot of what you lived and has come out on the other side? Or are you talking to someone who only has an intellectual understanding of it? Are you talking to them in a busy emergency room with them paying attention to 12 other things? Or are you talking to them in a room where they're looking at you in the eyes and only paying attention to you and having ears for just what you say and totally interested in protecting your interests? And I can guarantee you that those kinds of relationships will influence how you feel the effects of a psychoactive substance.
David, are there studies that you've looked at that really support what you're saying about the significance of these social context factors?
And there are a number of studies that show that the personality of the therapist goes a longer way to explain whether a person finds a drug helpful than the drug or the model of therapy the therapist is using or the length of the therapy, but just the personal attributes and qualities of the therapist, whether they are strict biological psychiatrists or whether they are humanistic psychologists, the clients will often rate themselves as improved depending on the qualities of the person they're dealing with.
Well, David, this raises, I think, a question that I think some listeners may have. which is, well, does this mean that you just have to change your beliefs, that it's really ultimately my fault or my responsibility, or it's all up to me, that if I just believe I'm going to get better, everything will get better? And that's not what you're saying. This is not something that just can be chosen, that you can just believe differently.
Because you can believe in something but still get hurt. You could believe someone's claim that this will help you, but it now may turn out that it doesn't help you. Now, if we take 100 people that are being given a certain drug, well, for some people, those factors that I've mentioned, the context, the healing space, the healing attitude, your own expectation reverberated by the media, by everything, that it is going to work, all that put together, well, for easily 30, 40% of people, well, that might work. You know, they believe in it, and those other things are playing to some greater or lesser degree. And then, yes, quote unquote, it works. They say, yeah, I like this. Yes, it's helped me. Yes, I got over my hump. Yes, I can do what I wanted to do. Yes, this works for me. Yes, I think I could take it again. Yes, I think I will take it again. But for some people, they will believe that. But nevertheless, the belief will be belied by the effect. It won't be interpreted as positive because they actually got hurt. Their arm can't move. They can't get up. They're eating all the time and they're sleeping all the time and they fell asleep at the wheel. Their spouse tells them, you're so aggressive now. Or their spouse or friend tells them, you're sleeping all the time. I can't reach you. So they slowly come to realize, well, maybe this is not helping me. So despite a belief, despite a whole bunch of positive attitudes on their end and on their healer's end, if you will, it's not working for them. So all of this overcomes belief.
So this is different than the idea, just the power of positive thinking, or just the idea of visualizing some kind of positive outcome for people.
Completely different, because by definition, if you're sincere about it, if you believe it, then there's no visualizing. You're not working towards trying to get better. You just believe it. You're just going along. And a lot of this is just being experienced, not with you saying, oh, yes, this is a good place for me. Yes, I trust this person. You're not necessarily saying that. You're just experiencing that.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is David Cohen. He's a professor at the School of Social Work at Florida International University. He's a therapist who has longtime experience working with psychiatric medications, including coming off medications. He's a longtime collaborator with the Psychiatric Survivor Movement and co-author of more than a dozen books, including Your Drug May Be Your Problem, co-authored with Peter Bregan, in French, A Critical Guide to Psychiatric Medications, and his upcoming book is Mad Science, Psychiatric Coercion, Diagnosis, and Drugs, co-authored with Stuart Kirk and Tomi Gomori.
Since 2002, the Icarus Project has been navigating the space between brilliance and madness. Join us in celebrating 10 years of radical mental health on April 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in Portland. Icarus co-founders Jax McNamara and Sasha Altman-DeBrull will read from their new books, Jack's In Between Land and Sasha's Maps to the Other Side, The Adventures of a Bipolar Cartographer. That's April 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in Portland. More information at www.theicarusproject.net.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. And David, what are some of the implications for clinical practice around this social understanding of drug effect?
Well, number one, I think one of the major implications is that we need to rethink the notion that we can detect whether people need drugs. You know, this person needs a drug. I think that whole notion is based on the medical idea that, well, you have a disease and a drug will somehow cure or seriously reduce the pain or the bad consequences of that disease, therefore you need a drug. But in most of the problems that we prescribe psychoactive drugs for, that notion of need needs to be blown up literally in 1,000 pieces. It's not so much people need drugs, it's people have to decide, given their current circumstances, could this drug effect be useful to me? How long would it be useful to me for? what other options do I have? What are the costs of experiencing this effect? Because there's no simple short-term effect. Everything turns into a longer-term effect the longer I use the drug. And there's rebound effects, and there are withdrawal effects, and all that has to be factored in. And so those are some of the implications, is that a lot of what we've been taught about why drugs may be useful to people just has to be, you know, relearned. We have to invent new ways that people should decide, is this useful to me? Is this helpful to me? How could I make this a better experience? What else could I do?
So addressing the whole question of this idea that we can detect whether someone needs a drug or not, what are some other implications in terms of clinical practice or the way we use these medications and prescribe them?
One thing is it's hard to be, quote, against drugs or, quote, for drugs once you think this way. Then I think that, certainly speaking for myself, I've developed a huge respect for what people have to say about their experiences on drugs. So I really respect when a person tells me, I've been taking this drug and this thing has been the best thing that I've ever done in my life and I couldn't live without it. And I respect that. I say, this is a valid judgment because it tells me it works for them. And just as equally, I'll respect that another person tells me, this has been the worst thing that's happened to me. This has wrecked me, ruined my life. I'll never be the same person. I don't think I'll ever get over what this substance did to me. And I'll never regain the trust that I lost in people who recommended I take this, who told me this would help me, who insisted or who ignored my cries of help or my descriptions of the harm it was causing. So I respect that too, that kind of judgment. I think that's what this more social view of drug effects suggests that we do, that we take very seriously people who say this has helped me, and we take just as seriously people who say this is harming me.
But it doesn't necessarily mean we have to agree with the person when they say why the drug is effective. I know this drug is saving my life because I have this disease and the drug is targeting my psychosis and it tweaks my neurotransmitters.
And I don't agree with that personally. However, and I think the only analogy I can make is an analogy with religion. And I've heard people describe to me their religious beliefs or things they believe, whether it's astrology or Orthodox Judaism or Christianity or Buddhism or what have you. And some of those beliefs I might share or feel sympathy with or just find interesting, and others I don't. And so I respect these beliefs, but I don't necessarily have to agree with them. Or I don't have to say, therefore, I believe what you believe simply because you believe it.
And we don't have to necessarily accept a claim that's made that's an unscientific claim. Like, for example, well, we know schizophrenia is a brain disease. And, well, we actually have to step back from that and say, okay, that's maybe your belief. But just like you believe in a Christian God or a Buddhist spiritual practice, there isn't a scientific support for that as a truth statement in a sense.
But that's a slightly, if I may bring in maybe a subtle definition or subtle distinction here. There's a slight difference between the issue of, does the person have a condition called schizophrenia? I think that's an empirical question. And I think we can show, no, they don't. You know, there's nothing that distinguishes them from other people who are said not to have the condition. There's no phenomenon that we can identify and keep saying that, you know, here's what's different inside these people. And the only thing we'd have to say is something is different in their body. For us to say that this condition called schizophrenia is a fact of nature, not just a consequence of our own just judgment.
And we absolutely have not been able to do that scientifically for however many 50, 60, 70 years that they've been searching for such a biological abnormality or difference. There's no empirical evidence of that claim.
No, but that's a different story than a person saying, I believe this drug works for me because I have this disease, or something else. Like, I believe this drug works for me because it works for me. And I can respect them believing that. I may have a different judgment on whether this drug is in fact working for them. According to my own understanding of what's in their interest, I may feel this drug is screwing them up. They may feel this drug is helping me. So I can understand that difference of opinion, and I can still see as valid that they believe it helps them, but I don't have to agree with them. And sometimes I may discuss with them what I see that suggests to me that it's not helping them, but I do it with as much respect as I can muster.
And what are some of the implications of this view of psychoactive substances as really being socially constructed to such a strong degree? What are some of the implications for the coming off medications process? Because I know that there are many people who are really working on coming off medications or considering coming off medications, and they're trying to really figure out, well, what is this drug doing to me, and how do I really approach coming off in an effective way? What are some of the implications of this for that?
You know, we may not have too much time, but let me suggest that whereas it's a natural thing, I feel, to take medications, you know, when we're in our society and maybe in human society, we're encouraged to take things and swallow things when we have a boo-boo, you know, a problem by our parents, by everything. It's a little less natural to stop taking things, perhaps. It's just something that seems to me to organize the way people work. Medications. So whereas to find a medication useful, you don't really have to do anything but just kind of go along and experience that, hey, this person's nice and sincere and let's see what happens. When you want to stop taking a drug, I think you have to change your belief. And so here I think it requires something a little more active. And there's two parts to this. Number one, I think that the most important thing is to change your idea about what this drug was doing to you. That's really key. And that frees you from this, you know, from your idea that this drug was in fact helping you. Usually when people want to stop, they've already come to some kind of belief like this. Not all of them, but many of them now have serious doubts. They're in pain. They're hurting. They're literally hurting. They've got sometimes major physical problems that the drug's been inducing for years or months. And they say, this is not good for me. But they're not quite free of the idea that maybe I don't need a drug. Maybe I could use something else.
Well, this is the big reason why I think the idea of a disease process and that the drug is treating a disease process is so problematic, is that it closes off that exploration of other possibilities. It creates a lot of fear. I mean, I was working with a client the other day who was told by her doctor, if you don't take an antidepressant, you are endangering your unborn child because women who are pregnant with depression, the depression is toxic to the child. And this is just such a fear message that so many people are getting, that there's a disease process. I have to take the pill to counteract the disease process, or these terrible things are going to happen to me, maybe even suicide or madness or even to my children. And that's the problem with that rigid message that we give, is that it closes off other options for people.
Well, it certainly does. I think that these sorts of messages, they're not new. They're messages that authorities have always given to people trying to move away from the grips of the authorities. They've always said, no, 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 stick with what I've been teaching you or doing with you, because if you do something else, you're really going to get hurt and it's going to be very bad for you. And that's, so there's really nothing for me to say too much about this, except that, you know, if you don't recognize propaganda for propaganda, then there's really nothing for you to do, you know, until you recognize it, until either through some teaching or hearing someone speak on the radio or something, you decide, well, maybe what I've been told is propaganda. Maybe it's just a claim. And I have to look at the interests of the person who's making the claim and wonder who's really benefiting from that claim. Am I really benefiting? So it's a kind of a consciousness raising thing that has to occur with yourself, but with other people. And it's through those encounters that you come to maybe have a different point of view about the usefulness of believing that you should follow this person's advice.
And that's why it's so important that we get a diversity of stories out there, that we're not just hearing the stories of people who the medications have helped and they feel saved by the medications, but we're also hearing the stories of people who are like, look, this medication didn't work for me. I got off of it and now I'm doing much better. We need to hear those stories as well. David, you're the co-author of more than a dozen books, and tell us about the new book that you have coming out soon.
The new book is probably a very exciting book for me because it was written with Stuart Kirk and Tomi Gomori. And we got together to look at the three major revolutions in psychiatry for the last 40 to 60 years, the whole shift to community treatment, the move to a descriptive style of diagnosis called the DSM, and the massive increase in prescribed psychoactive drugs. So we've looked at each of those so-called revolutions, and basically we deconstruct them and find that these revolutions are really illusions, and they're what we call mad science.
And that's the title of the book.
That's the title of the book, and it's coming out in February or March 2013 with Transaction Publishers.
And it's called Mad Science, Psychiatric Coercion, Diagnosis, and Drugs.
That's correct.
David, we don't have very much time left. Can you just tell us how people can get in touch with you and if there's a website or a way that they can get more information about you and your work?
My email address is cohenda@fiu.edu, and that is spelled cohenda@fiu.edu. And the website I created, which is an online course on psychotropic meds, a critical curriculum for child welfare professionals and mental health professionals, is criticalthinkrx.org.
David Cohen, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you very much, Will Hall. It shall remain a pleasure to have been on your show.
You've been listening to an interview with David Cohen. He's a professor of the School of Social Work at Florida International University. He's a longtime therapist who's worked with psychiatric medications and people coming off psychiatric medications. His collaboration with the psychiatric survivor movement goes back many decades and includes being co-author of a number of books, including with Peter Bregan, Your Drug May Be Your Problem, and in French, A Critical Guide to Psychotropic Medications. His new book is co-authored with Stuart Kirk and Tomi Gomori, and it's called Mad Science, Psychiatric Coercion, Diagnosis, and Drugs. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscasts. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
The Community for Earth and Economic Justice Action Group and Alliance for Democracy will screen Bitter 70 on March 8th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. In 2008, University of Utah economics student and Unitarian Universalist Tim DeChristopher committed an act which would redefine patriotism in our time. Follow Tim, Bitter 70, from college student to incarcerated felon. He bid millions of dollars he didn't have to save thousands of pristine acres of land surrounding U.S. national parks. KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of this film screening. More information can be found at kboo.fm/bitter70film2013.
This Wednesday at 6 p.m., tune in to Treasures from the KBOO Vault. We'll feature an interview conducted by Margaret Butler with two representatives of Voices of Hope and Anger, women who are fighting the presence of United States military bases domestically and internationally.
Who have, through sharing our stories, our personal experiences, and our work opposing militarism, have made connections. And we have established the fact that our struggles are linked. And that's sometimes difficult to do just with words.
And we'll also listen to a recording of Joan Baez performing in the early 1970s at Reed College. That's this Wednesday at 6 p.m. here on KBOO Portland.
Oh, yeah. These are your KBOO Noon News headlines for March 4th, 2013. I'm Jimmy Tardy. With the continued mystery surrounding the health of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, demonstrators took to the streets of Caracas, Venezuela over the weekend to demand that the Supreme Court investigate whether Mr. Chavez is well enough to remain in office as president. Having only been offered, quote, proof of life photos of the ailing president, speculation has been common over whether Mr. Chavez is capable of performing the duties of his office, with many concerned that Mr. Chavez may in fact be deceased. In an effort to urge the country's Supreme Court to determine Mr. Chavez's overall health condition, several university students have chained themselves together near a Supreme Court office. Following rioting that has killed more than 60 people, authorities in Bangladesh have banned all gatherings in Bogra in North Bangladesh. The riots were sparked by the death sentence handed to a leader of Jamaat-e-Islami, Bangladesh's largest Islamist party. Jamaat-e-Islami was part of the government of former Prime Minister Khaleda Zia from 2001 until 2006. Zia claims that the trials are politically motivated. Zia's party, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, has called for a nationwide general strike for Tuesday. The University of Mississippi Medical Center announced on Sunday at the Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections in Atlanta that they have achieved the first functional cure of an HIV patient. According to Dr. Hannah Gay, the 2.5-year-old girl who was born with HIV needs no medication for HIV, has a normal life expectancy, and is highly unlikely to be infectious to others. Treating the infant within 30 hours of birth, doctors administered 3 antiviral drugs to the child, as opposed to the standard regimen of a single drug. Expecting the girl to be dependent on the drugs for life, doctors were surprised when her viral load, the amount of virus present in her blood, fell below detectable levels within a month. Now, 2.5 years later, the child has shown no viral load at all for the past year without taking any antiviral medications. Doctors believe the child was cured due to the fact that the drugs were administered so quickly after being infected and are now working to determine if this is a rare response or if the technique will be usable for other infected newborns. For KBOO Noon News,